Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A big week, fire and flood, a big anniversary of 9/11. The president puts a stake in the ground on jobs and his GOP challengers debate. President Obama addressed Congress last night and laid down a jobs plan and challenge of his own.
The question is whether, in the face of an ongoing national crisis, we can stop the political circus and actually do something to help the economy.
At the Ronald Reagan Library in California, Texas Governor Rick Perry joined GOP contenders in debate and came out blazing on Social Security.
It is a Ponzi scheme to tell our kids that are 25 or 30 years old today, you're paying into a program that's going to be there. Anybody that's for the status quo with Social Security today is involved with a monstrous lie to our kids.
And new archival sound goes public as if we needed more reminders on a heartfelt anniversary of 9/11.
Another one just hit the building.
Wow.
Oh my God, we just
another one just hit
it. Another one just hit the roof.
The whole building just came apart.
Oh my God.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with John Meacham, Zanny Mitten-Beddoes, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the president's push on jobs, of the GOP contenders, the fires in Texas, the anniversary? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from New York City is John Meacham, executive editor and executive vice president at Random House, former editor of Newsweek, contributing editor now at the PBS show Need to Know. Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His books include American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House, and American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation. John Meacham, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks so much.
Also with us from Washington, Zanny Mitten-Beddoes, economics editor at The Economist. She oversees the magazine's economics coverage across the world. Zanny Mitten-Beddoes, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Tom.
And hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Zanny, and John.
We've got a lot on our plate today, and of course, like the rest of the country, jobs and Obama's speech right in our laps. Let's listen to a little bit right here.
The purpose of the American Jobs Act is simple: to put more people back to work and more money in the pockets of those who are working. It will create more jobs for construction workers, more jobs for teachers, more jobs for veterans, and more jobs for long-term unemployed. It will provide a tax break for companies who hire new workers, and it will cut payroll taxes in half for every working American and every small business.
Jack Beattie, I don't know how many Americans watched this last night. The president, before a joint session of Congress, there was some difficulty in getting that session together at all, given Republican skepticism and scheduling conflicts. But for people who didn't see it, this was not the same old, same old. Barack Obama, we'll get to the merits of the plan, but the man was on a different wavelength than he's been in some recent down addresses.
He was all fired up and ready to go for the first time in a long time. Chuck Todd of MSNBC reported that the White House pruned out Washington speak from the speech. The word infrastructure, for example, never appeared, and yet again and again we heard infrastructure described. And there was a vigor and a thrust to the whole speech, and a boldness just when people were starting to count the president out on leadership. I mean, that has been his it had worked for him before the summer, and his ratings there have just plummeted. And so he gave a powerful, vigorous speech. Now, can a speech change anything? Remains to be seen.
John Meacham, will come to the politics of it, but what about the public? And this president and him pushing hard, the public feeling a lot of pain for unemployment, people without jobs, or many, many of us knowing those without jobs. Do you feel a public receptive to a president saying, we can do this, and here's how?
Absolutely. And I think the president finally began to live up to what a lot of people hoped he would be doing in that job, which is being very articulate, very passionate, very centrist in many ways. There's more in this plan, actually, for Democrats to sacrifice than for Republicans in many ways. And I think given the unease, given the real fear, and, as you say, the real pain in the country, I think having a president who seems thoroughly engaged is essential, not just for the politics of it, which all of us are obsessed with, but for the real hope of economic recovery, because so much of the economy is about the psychology of confidence. And what I was struck by with the president last night is one of my favorite anecdotes from his first book about growing up is about his stepfather teaching him to box in Indonesia and how his stepfather landed a punch. And Obama remembers the taste and the feel of the Everlast leather. And he stayed there and fought and fought and fought until he landed the blows. And if you ask Hillary Clinton, if you ask John McCain, if you ask a lot of people in that chamber last night who think they should be up there giving those speeches, this is a guy who knows how to throw a punch. He has not in a long time. And I think that for the first time we saw that in an existential crisis, which is what his political career is facing, he knows how to do it.
Zanny, I want to come to you on the substance and the politics of this. The president, very aware of the whole framework last night, of the real pain in the country, but also the real opposition in that chamber. Here he was.
Already the media has proclaimed that it's impossible to bridge our differences. And maybe some of you have decided that those differences are so great that we can only resolve them at the ballot box. But know this. The next election is 14 months away. And the people who sent us here, the people who hired us to work for them, they don't have the luxury of waiting 14 months.
It is a long time and painful if you're out of work, and many, many are. Zanny, look at the substance here first. You know, the initial critique, though some conciliatory sounds from the GOP, but the initial critique also, more stimulus, we've done that, it didn't work. Many economists around the world saying we need more stimulus. Look at the package on its merits. Zanny, what do you see?
I see a pretty good package. I think this was a superb achievement, both substantively and politically. And as John said, the president had a vigor, a passion, a boldness that we really haven't seen for a long time. But on the substance, he had to do two things. He had to come up with a plan which stimulates job growth immediately. He had to stop the economy slipping back into recession. And the mainstream view amongst many economists is that what the US needed was short-term stimulus in return for medium-term fiscal tightening. And that's pretty much what he laid out. And he did it in a way that put forward proposals that many of which are going to be hard for Republicans politically to say no to. I think they're ones that have, and he chose policies which have had Republican support in the past, and he chose that for good reason, to maximize the chances of some or most of this getting into law.
Is this different from the first big round of stimulus, almost $800 billion, that Americans saw soon after Barack Obama came to office?
It's different in size, obviously, although given that most of this is happening over 1 year, it's very, very bold. It's somewhat different in the composition. I mean, much of this is an extension of and an expansion of payroll tax cuts. Now, you can argue about whether that's the most effective way to stimulate jobs growth, but it's certainly, if you adjust for the likelihood of Republican passage, then I think it comes very close to the top of the list.
Jack, economists say it may not be the most effective way to stimulate growth in terms of putting cash in people's pocket, but it may be the only way the president has a chance of getting through the GOP. He knows that, and he spoke to that last night, sort of tweaking the Republicans, even as he called for a bipartisan effort here.
I know that some of you have sworn oaths to never raise any taxes on anyone for as long as you live. Now is not the time to carve out an exception and raise middle-class taxes, which is why you should pass this bill right away.
Jack, it will indeed feel like a tax hike if the payroll cut exemption that's been there for a lot of people for a while now goes away in January. What about that challenge?
Yes, I mean, they'll have to honor their commitment to Grover Norquist if they're going to be true to their compass. You know, the Republicans have given it mixed reception. Someone pointed out that last year when the tax cut in payroll taxes was connected to an extension of the Bush tax cut for the most affluent. Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee was for a payroll tax cut. He said it was a good idea. He was quoted on NPR yesterday morning saying, "I really don't know about a payroll tax cut. They really don't seem like such a good idea to keep this going." So hypocrisy never stopped politicians from doing what's expedient. But the question is, what is expedient now? I think I'm encouraged by Eric Cantor's receptivity, at least ostensible receptivity, to extending the payroll tax cut to deepening it. That, I think, is hopeful. On the other hand, you see Paul Ryan and other people say, "Oh, that's just a sugar rush. It isn't what we need. We need permanent tax cuts." So one doesn't know. I think that of these elements, that's the one that has the best chance to get through.
John, can you see a real chance of this here, or is it time for Republicans to draw a line in the sand, you know, stick to their line, it didn't work before, we won't vote for it now, and say no?
Well, you know, I thought the president had some fun with the Republicans last night, and they had fun with him back when he said, "I know many of you think that we should just shut the government down and pull a kind of Ron Paul-ism," and they cheered.
There came the cheers, yeah. They betcha.
Yeah, you're right. We did think that. But, one of the things that's going on elsewhere in the conversation this week that I think sheds light on this is this tension between Rick Perry and Mitt Romney over Social Security, where Romney has been arguing that to take on Social Security, again, in an existential way, is political death for the Republicans. When you transfer that kind of tactical, realistic analysis to the Jobs Act and what was going on last night in Washington, what's going on today as the Republicans decide how to react, I think you will have a more pragmatic reaction.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. The president throws down a gauntlet on jobs. The GOP debates. Texas burns. And the nation remembers 9/11, complete with some kind of terror warning out there right now. Zanny Mittenbeddows is with us, economics editor for The Economist magazine. John Meacham, former editor of Newsweek, now at Random House, author of American Lion and American Gospel, contributing editor at the PBS show Need to Know. Our own Jack Beatty's here, and let's go right to our listeners. Paul in Riverside, Iowa. Thanks for calling, Paul. You're on the air.
Thanks. My point was, why would we give Obama another $400 billion when we haven't seen any results from the $900 billion we gave him earlier?
Or the $787 billion. I made the same number mistake the other day, so I'm right with you, but we take your point loud and clear. And Zanny, I have heard it put just that way by Republican Congressman even this morning, that Paul puts it from Iowa. Let's look at that one more time. $787 billion or plus before, $400 and some billion now, and it will be carved down to that question. You're the economics editor. How do you answer it?
Well, it obviously will be carved out of that question. Let me give you one response, and it's hard to deal in counterfactuals in politics, but I think it is true to say that absent the first stimulus, we would be in a much worse situation now than we actually are. So it did have an impact. It didn't have a big enough impact to put us in a strong economy, but it did have an impact. And what this new 400 and some odd billion is doing is essentially preventing the economy from moving very fast to a very tight fiscal policy. Because if we're not going to put this in place, then what happens? The temporary payroll tax extension ends on December 31st this year.
Yep.
The existing stimulus is coming to an end, and we have the equivalent of a tightening of fiscal policy. And we have fiscal policy tightening just as the economy has completely stalled. Many people worry about it slipping back into recession. And so the last thing this very fragile economy needs right now is sharply tighter fiscal policy. And it's worth pointing out that on current law, the U.S. is about to have one of the biggest fiscal tightenings next year of any big country, Western country. So it's a very big tightening if you did nothing. And I see this new package less as a whole new big stimulus package and more as smoothing the adjustment so we don't have this very big tightening coming straight away. And for that reason, I don't think it's going to have a huge impact. I don't think we're going to see 1980s-style growth rates next year or the year after because we are in the aftermath of a huge bust. But I think it prevents us from falling off, or it ought to help prevent us from falling off the cliff next year. And I really, really worry about a double-dip recession, and I think this makes it somewhat less likely.
That fear is widespread. I mean, Jack, the president wants to do it now, even if it's just adds a point or so to growth and gets unemployment down by a point or maybe a little more. I mean, that's what I see economists saying here, but that's in the right direction instead of falling off a cliff if it would work that way. You hear him setting up the campaign. If it comes to that, he says it may have to come to the election box, and he's saying, okay, we can't afford everything. People are saying it's time for truth-telling. We can't afford it all, so what's it going to be, teachers or tax cuts for the rich? You know, he's starting to put it in those very, very stark election-speak kind of terms, Jack.
He is. Somebody said, give him hell, Barry, was the undercurrent there. He is definitely setting up the grammar, if you will, of that fall campaign. If the GOP, if they give him some of this, that will, I think, moderate his position some. If they reject him across the board, then he does have a Harry Truman-like position vis-a-vis them, and he said, "I'm going to take it to the country." He's going today or shortly to Richmond, which is the home city of
Eric Cantor's town.
Yes, and next week it's to Ohio, John Boehner's country, and he's going to go around the country and talk up these things. And I've heard some suggestions that they may actually go to a particular congressman's districts and say, you know, there are 12 bridges in this district that need that are substandard. Do you want your congressman to vote to fix those bridges, or do you want him to reject this package? What do you say, folks? If he really sort of specifies it like that, it could become uncomfortable for some of these Republicans.
Well, an endurance test in a way for the GOP. Yes. I mean, watching Joe Biden stand up and clap and John Boehner just sit behind the president last night while the economy is where it is. David in Aiken, South Carolina. You're on the air, David.
Hello, Tom. Yeah, speaking about the Republicans, it just seems like the media doesn't really call them to task like they should. It's all about how the president isn't this, the president isn't that, the Democrats don't do this, the Democrats don't do that. I've been voting now since I turned 18 in 1976. I've been at every election for the past 35 years. I voted mostly conservative for a lot of those years. They lost their credibility with me. They run up the deficit. This is the Republicans. The Republicans run up the deficit, and they don't pay for it, ever. They ran it up year after year after year after year after year from one administration of theirs to the next.
But they say they want to bring it down right now, David.
Account for it.
They say they want to bring it down right now. What about that? Right now, they say they're ready to do it.
Why should I believe them? They said the same thing. They said they talk out of one side of their mouth, and then they do something out of the other. Why should I believe them? They say that the reducing taxes on the rich is going to create more jobs. They've had that now since 2 years before the crash.
Yep.
Where are the jobs?
Yep.
They haven't been created.
David,
they're getting the tax cut.
We've got it, David. We hear it. Let me get one more. Jerry in Cookeville, Tennessee. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you think?
Well, I just thought this was just pure tautology from the president. And it seems like most of the media that I've listened to and some on your panel, they kind of have a theomorphic view of this.
Theomorphic? This what does that mean?
He's kind of a godlike.
Godlike?
Anyway, if he was really serious about the jobs, he would have mentioned that how in Wisconsin, how Scott Walker, with his policies, is going to create a surplus. They're not laying off teachers. They're hiring teachers. In fact, Richard Trumka went there earlier this year and called his tactics Nazi-like tactics.
Well, I mean,
he was sitting right there next to the first lady.
Jerry, I don't have those numbers in front of me, but we know what an uproar Wisconsin has been in. There'll be a lot of talk about all these different scenes before we get to an election. I appreciate your call. One more, Robert in Burlington, Vermont. Robert, you're on.
Hi. These congressional Republicans, they are the most unsophisticated, little childlike, mendacious liars. They accuse Obama of exactly the sin that they themselves do. Eric Cantor last night told Bob Schieffer that Obama was telling him, well, it's my way or the highway. You know, after what they did last month to the nation, President Cavin gives them everything that they demand, and they won't take yes for an answer. And then last night, you know, the most reasonable, I mean, it's still an underpowered what do you call that?
Or program or initiative here?
Yeah, initiative.
You want more? And we get the mendacious business. Robert, I appreciate your call. John Meacham, the president last night, making a kind of fundamental play here. He said, look, what kind of country are we? Yes, we're rugged individualists, but we've done things together. We've built railroads and highways and, you know, the research institutions and public land-grant universities, all that together. What's it going to be? He's making an appeal. He's making a play for that American soul. But the Republicans are making their own play, and there's a lot of fire on that side. We'll come to it. What do you think, John? Who's got the horsepower when it comes to grabbing that heart?
Well, I think the theomorphic view is probably the key one. I think that the president is making a Clintonian, in the best sense, argument, which is government matters. We have lived in a mixed economy since Alexander Hamilton built the system he built, and there's a role to play. And these kind of the Manichaean choices that, you know, it's all free market or it's all socialism are, in fact, false categories. And I think that's true, and I think people intuitively know that. And I think that it will resonate because, for once, and I think the president has a bad habit of building up straw men that are too easy to knock down.
Mm-hmm.
He only did that once or twice last night, maybe only once, actually.
Okay. Okay.
And I think it was there was more, to borrow a phrase from the other side, there was more straight talk here than we've had in a good while. And so I think people will respond to candor, and I think people will respond to arguments based on history, and mentioning the GI Bill and talking about the interstate highway system and talking about, you know, rescuing these the big programs is in fact part of the American narrative.
It did seem like less palaver, more straight talk. David in Orlando, Florida. David, you're on the air.
Yes, why is he targeting teachers, firemen, police again when the sector that's hurting the most is manufacturing? That needs the help. Teachers, firemen, police don't have the unemployment record levels that manufacturing is. Those people need help now.
Let us pick it up. Zanny Mittenbettos, there's a caller in Orlando. You know, why help state and local governments out with teachers and fire and all the rest and not go to manufacturing? Is that what the president's doing, or is he doing both? There's also a tax break in here for at least smaller businesses. I don't know if that's manufacturing.
Exactly. I think the president is, in fact, doing both. I mean, the reason for going through state and local governments is that that's a very quick way to stop people being laid off. State and local governments are laying people off. If you funnel more money to them, then they don't have to lay them off. But there are many parts of this which are designed to encourage people to hire unemployed workers. The payroll tax cut itself will encourage hiring, and that will encourage hiring across the private sector. So I think it's not accurate to say that this was only targeted at public sector workers. There was, you know, there was something there for everything, and a sort of multiple approach to try and encourage hiring.
But why is that there? Is that buying votes, or is that buying a shot at better economic growth?
Well, I suspect in the political side calculus in the White House, the first matters more. But I think the basic substance of this policy was exactly designed to maximize employment growth in the short term, prevent this fiscal vice that I was talking about dragging the economy down,
yep,
and to prop up growth next year.
Litchfield, Connecticut. David's calling. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. I would just like to comment that you get a lot of really beautiful rhetoric with politicians about cutting taxes, about limiting social programs, about, honestly, lazy people leeching off the government. What's really not mentioned is the tax breaks and things that they're wanting to add to companies. That's really part of the problem that we're facing.
Why?
We've got companies like Apple that's sitting on $50 billion. And I love an iPhone. iPhone's really cool. But it employs a few thousand people in the U.S. and over 100,000 in China. All of the wealth that we're spending with a company like Apple it needs to be redistributed in the U.S.
But that's actually what President Obama said last night, Dave. He said that's part of the reason he wants to get this tax break to smaller businesses, not to the bigger ones. What about that? Do you think it'll work?
I think that it's a better approach. The trickle-down economics, it's, you know, people who fund politicians, and I just really, lobbyists and things really just fund politicians, they have the money to get the rhetoric and to get the people in place that will help them vote for the tax breaks and the things that's in their best interest, but not in the American public's best interest.
Yeah, David, I appreciate your call. You hear Americans starting to make real distinctions here, Zanny, in the way they listen to this. And, you know, where are things? Where are they going to go? What's going to stay at home? Where does the aid go? Does that really make jobs here or somewhere else? I mean, people are really boring in on this now, Zanny.
Yeah, and with good reason. You know, we're 3 years into an extremely tough economic environment, and I'm not surprised at that. And I think that that's part of the reason, you know, this package tries several different approaches, and we can argue about whether they're the right ones. I think that it's a package based on a political calculus, what can get through Congress as much as an economic one. But you're absolutely right. People are, of course, they're saying, we need to know what works, and we don't see much evidence of a very strong economy, so we're a bit skeptical of what's been done so far. I completely understand that. But I think that what this package does try and do is to take the sort of most mainstream, sensible economic ideas, the ones that are most likely to get some Republican support, and therefore have the greatest likelihood of being put into action fast, because there isn't much time to lose here. The economy is stalling, and if it is hit by a big fiscal tightening next year, if the payroll tax cut, for example, is not extended, that will help weaken an already very, very weak economy. And I think that's the fundamental calculus, the substantive level that's going on here.
Let's turn the microscope, the telescope, in a different direction out to California, the Ronald Reagan Library there in Simi Valley, the big old Air Force One that he used above that big stage full of Republican contenders for the GOP presidential nomination. Lots of talk about jobs there. Rick Perry, governor of Texas, saying, I've made a lot. Mitt Romney, former governor of Massachusetts, saying, well, be careful what you claim credit for there, Rick. Here's Mitt Romney.
Texas is a great state. Texas has zero income tax. Texas has a right-to-work state, a Republican legislature, a Republican Supreme Court. Texas has a lot of oil and gas in the ground. Those are wonderful things. But Governor Perry doesn't believe that he created those things. If he tried to say that, why, it'd be like Al Gore saying he invented the Internet. Look, the reality is there are differences. There are differences between states.
Republican joy when you get to tweak Al Gore and your opponent at the same time. John Meacham, what about the GOP approach on jobs? There was a lot of talk about it on Wednesday night there in California. Rick Perry, you know, making no bones about his claim to have done a great job on that front. Some poking back as well. What about their approach?
Well, I think you put your finger on it when you say there's a lot of talk about it. You know, I have an enormous amount of sympathy for really anyone who sits behind that desk in the Oval Office or in Congress to some extent, because it is very hard, as we all know, for the government to move this size of an economy in a significant way with any speed. And it's, what, a $14 trillion economy, something like that.
But Rick Perry says, I made a million jobs. That's more than, you know, X, Y, or Z.
Right. But as Governor Romney said, you've got, you know, what kinds of jobs, to what extent does a governor really, to what extent is it legitimate for a governor to claim credit for that? A lot of governors, particularly in the South, where I come from, spend a lot of time removing tax barriers, enticing industry, and that's great, but, you know, a president has a harder time doing that. What I have a feeling is going to happen is, and I think the president put his finger on it last night, is there are going to be two separate conversations going on. One is going to be a tactical political one. And interesting, I think Perry said something about, well, that's a nice intellectual conversation. I think there'll be a lot of nice intellectual conversations, and Republicans will be able for the next 14 months to say, if only I were in charge, then we would be living in a land of milk and honey.
I'm I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, fires rage in central Texas. More than 50 square miles burned. Here's Robert Hadlock of Texas local TV station KXAN on Thursday.
Two people were killed in that fire. 1,300 people have no home to go to. 34,000 acres scorched, and that fire still 30% contained.
Heavy flooding on the Susquehanna River and in the Northeast could be one for the record books. Here's a resident of Derry Township with CBS 21 of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
I've lived here all my life, 56 years now, and it's the worst I've ever seen. I went through the 72 flood, and this actually is probably going to end up beating that.
And a new message allegedly from Libya's ousted Colonel Muammar Gaddafi claiming he's still in Libya and vowing to fight on against rebels he calls germs, rats, and scumbags. Scumbags. I wonder how you say that in Libyan. Zanny Mittenbedos is with us from The Economist in Washington, D.C. John Meacham is with us from New York City, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of American Lion and American Gospel, former editor of Newsweek. Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to Laura in Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks so much for taking my call. I just wanted to give a perspective from here in Des Moines. As far as infrastructure goes, we've seen a lot of road work being done, which is kind of a pain in the butt when you're driving to work. But for the most part...
Yeah, but not if you're working on that job. You're happy for it then.
That's right. That's right. I mean, these are men and some women being put to work, and I think that's great. I think probably a lot of that is federal money coming down. On the other hand, our Republican governor, Branstad, has foregone the money for the light rail system that so many people here in Iowa were looking at as not only to create jobs but to give us a way to have cheaper transportation and bring people to Des Moines, because we do know there is a little bit of an exodus issue that we have here.
You've seen Rick Perry. You've seen Rick Perry talking a lot in Iowa and beyond. What do you think about his claims on job creation in Texas? Do you think he's got the model?
Well, I think you have to look at the full picture. I mean, we know a lot of people came over to Texas from after Katrina happened. We know a lot of these people aren't making livable wages. They're not getting benefits. So I don't know if that's, I mean, it looks good from the outside, but I think if you take the blinders off and really look at it, I know that they're behind. Only Mississippi is worse when it comes to child hunger. And that was an article today in the Des Moines Register about how hungry the children are in Texas. So I'd like to know what he says about that.
We're going to talk more about low-wage jobs here on Monday, but I appreciate your call, Laura. And let me get one more, Pamela in Hampstead, New Hampshire. Pamela, you're on.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really confused as to why I don't hear anything from either party, Republicans or Democrats, about an investment tax credit vis-a-vis what Reagan did.
How would that work? You're a small businesswoman. How would that work?
Thank you. It happened. I remember like 20 years ago, we did a practice. We have a dental practice. We did a practice loan, and we got a 10% tax credit, which came right off of what we, you know. So instead of paying $80,000 for the tax, we paid $70,000, and it made a big difference.
So whatever you'd put into your business, you'd get some credit for that right off the top of your taxes. Zanny, what about this payroll tax break for businesses instead of, let's say, an investment tax credit?
Well, there is an extension of the expensing, the full expensing, which is also a current tax break in this package. But I think the idea for focusing on the payroll tax is as an incentive to hire people. Mm-hmm. That if you cut payroll taxes, or if you're increasing your overall wage bill, hiring a new person, giving pay rises to your existing workforce, you pay no payroll taxes up to a certain limit on that new stuff. I think this is sort of tinkering designed to maximize the incentive for firms to put more people on the payroll, because this is, after all, a jobs package. It's not a kind of long-term how to improve the tax code package, and there are many ways in which this country could and should do that. But this was designed specifically to get sort of maximum bang for the buck in terms of short-term job creation.
Yeah, so lots of ways to thread the needle. Pamela would rather have the investment tax credit, but President Obama looking first at hiring last night. John Meacham raised Rick Perry and his comments on Social Security, some back and forth with Mitt Romney on that. Let's listen to a little bit. This is Wednesday night. They're in California at the Ronald Reagan Library. The Texas governor pushed back against critics, including Mitt Romney, who took issue with Perry's statements that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme.
You cannot keep the status quo in place and not call it anything other than a Ponzi scheme. It is. That is what it is. Americans know that. And regardless of what anyone says, oh, it's not, and that's provocative language, maybe it's time to have some provocative language in this country and say things like, let's get America working again and do whatever it takes to make that happen.
So, John Meacham, maybe it's time to have some provocative language in this country again. Ponzi scheme, monstrous lies, get ugly with Ben Bernanke. You know, Rick Perry definitely not backing off that jut-jawed posture.
No, and it's going to be a terrific couple of months for those of us who follow these things. And I think it's, frankly, helpful to have that provocative language, helpful in terms of framing a Democratic lowercase d debate about which direction do we want to go in. Having stark choices is not necessarily a bad thing. I think that a lot of people who have looked at it would argue that Social Security, to call it a monstrous lie, is probably hotter than a lot of people would want to go. But the fact that we have enormous issues with the future of entitlements in the country is...
Which the president raised last night, ready to do something on that.
Inarguable, mm-hmm. Exactly. And so, you know, I once, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, proposed that Dick Cheney, if he really thought that President Obama was making the country less safe, that Cheney should run for president this year. And let's, you know, let's have the debate, let's have the choice. And to some extent, I think that Perry is going to offer the Republican Party a direct chance to vote and the rest of the country a chance to look at where that part of the country is in a way that will be stark and unmistakable. And ultimately, I think that's good for democracy.
Yes, Jack, please.
Well, I was going to say, of course, the last time the GOP set up a presidential contest around a choice, not an echo, that was 1964. Yep. And it led to the Johnson landslide. And crucial, there are many reasons for that, but crucial to that was Barry Goldwater's disparagement of Social Security. Rick Perry is not backing away from his statements about it. You know, he had two, Republicans liked him for two reasons. By 10 points over Romney, they liked him because they thought he was electable. By only 6 points, they liked him more than Romney because they liked him on the issues. Well, Romney put it out. He basically was saying, look, let's examine that electability, folks. Can somebody talk about Social Security like this and be elected president of the United States? Of course, Perry comes back and he said, can we nominate somebody who'll blur the lines with the White House on the health care initiative? Yeah. Romneycare, Obamacare.
It may well be that the luckiest thing that ever happened to Mitt Romney, besides his marriage, is Rick Perry.
Maybe, but you know, I mean, it's not 1964, 65 anymore. You've got analysts out there saying Barack Obama has been, anyway, so vulnerable that you can put a hard bar right out front and maybe still win with it. But, John, you mentioned Dick Cheney, and interestingly, he was in the news a little bit. I mean, it's quite a bit in the last couple of weeks. But on this front, interview with Diane Sawyer of ABC News aired on Wednesday night, and the former vice president had criticism for many in the current field of GOP presidential candidates, Michelle Bachmann, John Huntsman, and Rick Perry. Here's a little bit where he's expressing disapproval of what he called Perry's over-the-top language. This is looking back at where he was talking about the Fed chairman Ben Bernanke, saying that they'd treat him pretty ugly, I believe, down in Texas if he played politics with U.S. monetary policy. Here's Dick Cheney.
I disagree with it. He's just getting started in his campaign. I'm not sure if he were to get elected, he'd want to use that kind of language on the Fed chairman. It's very important to respect the independence of the Fed. You don't want somebody at the Federal Reserve who's managing the place, quote, for politics. And I think the charge that Ben Bernanke or Alan Greenspan or others have done that isn't a valid charge, and would be, I would deem it inappropriate.
So there's the former vice president from the bleachers pitching in on this, but it was right there on the stage in California, John Huntsman, looking to play that kind of moderate voice on Wednesday night at the GOP debate and warning, insisting that his fellow Republican candidates' comments on climate change and evolution, where Rick Perry's been very skeptical about human-caused climate change and his skepticism on evolution elements there as well. Huntsman here, the former ambassador and governor, all the rest, saying that could get in the way of the GOP taking back the presidency.
When you make comments that fly in the face of what 98 out of 100 climate scientists have said, when you call into question the science of evolution, all I am saying is that in order for the Republican Party to win, we can't run from science. We can't run from mainstream conservative philosophy. We've got to win voters.
Don't run from science, John Huntsman says on that stage. And Jack, it's funny, it sounded like a new note.
It really did. because, of course, it's been an easy line for Republicans to sort of pander to, you know, skepticism about climate science and even skepticism about evolution. But I'm put in mind of Woodrow Wilson during the 1912 campaign. He was asked, Professor Wilson, do you believe in evolution? He looked at the question. He said, at this late date, to ask an intelligent man whether he believes in organic evolution, I just can't imagine. Of course I do. But there is a lot of, you know, there is that vein out there that distrusts science, that distrusts, and that especially sees the global warming science as tied into economic decline, you know. And I think Rick Perry was speaking to that. He was saying, if we believe this stuff, we're going to have to really change our economy. You may lose your job. Your car, your gas may get more expensive. Do you really want to make that kind of change on the basis of a theory? He had a good point, I think, for a certain kind of voter many voters who want to keep things more or less as they are.
John, we don't have a lot of time, but there's a caller here or a listener online asking if we can ask our Andrew Jackson's caller, that would be you, what Andrew Jackson would say about our current situation and how we got here.
Well, Jackson loved saying, I take the responsibility. He would never blame anybody else, run from a task. He believed very much that the president, he was the first president to articulate the principle that he was the only person directly elected by all the people, and that the president had a particular and sacred responsibility to lead the country as best he thought, and to go to the people, and to go around any intermediary institution, including the Congress of the United States, to do that. And I think the president, President Obama, had much more of a Jacksonian moment this week than he has in a long time. And I think a lot of the Republicans are going to be trying to seize some of that populist fury that is sometimes associated with Jackson. But here's the key thing about Andrew Jackson and the key thing about Ronald Reagan and the key thing about Franklin Roosevelt and Jack just mentioned Wilson. Great politicians are great compromisers, and they have principles and they love their country. But being a politician is about creating a majority to do something in a moment to try to make the country a little better. And I think a sense of realism and a sense of principled pragmatism is going to be something that the country is going to respond to, and we'll see whether it's the president or the Republican nominee who best represents it.
The key thing under this week and flowing very strong remembrance of 9/11, 10 years ago, it's amazing, on Sunday now, and it's a time that brings it all back. Here's a little newly released audio from September 11th, 2001. It includes this tape of flight number 11, American Airlines, attendant Betty Ong speaking to American Airlines reservations agents from that plane that was in the process of being hijacked. Just hear the brave calm in her voice.
Okay, my name is Betty Ong. I'm number 3 on flight 11.
Okay.
And the cockpit is not answering their phone. And there's somebody stabbed in business class, and we can't breathe in business class. Somebody's got mace or something.
And it brings it all back, and it's coming back for millions and millions of Americans and around the world as well this week. Zanny, here you are watching Americans look at this anniversary. What do you make of the way the country's looking again at 9/11, 10 years on?
Well, that audio brings that moment so terribly back. I think this is a moment for reflection, huge reflection, not just in this country but around the world. I think it's a moment, obviously, of enormous remembrance. But I think it's a time I can't help thinking how different the world is and the U.S. is than it was 10 years ago. And I was here 10 years ago on that terrible day. And I'm struck, and it's not just the result of the war on terror, it's the result of a huge economic crisis, but quite how differently the world views the U.S. and the U.S. views itself. Mm. And I'm trying to figure out in my own mind, separate what was the consequence of the reaction of the United States to those terrible events. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion now about whether there was overreaction or not. I'm not sure I really agree with that. Mistakes were clearly made, but, you know, Al-Qaeda has been eviscerated in its compared to where it was a decade ago. But remember, 10 years ago, there were concerns in Europe about the hyperpower of the United States. I don't think anyone really thinks too much about the hyperpower of the United States. And I think the rest of the world will come to regret being so worried about that. And I think they will find a U.S. turning inwards, focusing on itself, something much harder, actually, to come to terms with.
John Meacham, you're there in New York City. Your thoughts on this anniversary of this epic day?
How brief and how tactile and how human all history is. We've had a lovely time talking in very high conceptual terms about the state of the country, but the fragility of everything and how 10 years ago innocent people went to work to live their lives in one of the great symbols of American commerce and the great symbol of American military power, and those folks on Flight 93 who so courageously brought down the plane that might have hit the Capitol or the White House.
Yeah.
And I think that what you feel walking through the streets of the city this weekend, and certainly I felt it walking to work this morning, is this deep sense of connection and that we're all in this together.
Let us feel that right here, right now. We remember and we honor those who died. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks to all of you. This is On Point.